Fredman, I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I'd like to thank you people for bringing me up here to this extraordinary place. And I've just been having such a great weekend. I want to thank my host, Jeff, who's been driving me around and showing me all the stuff up here. And I'd like to welcome the new people to Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a great life today, and if you're new, I'm sure that thrills the crap out of you. I'm sure it thrills you. I'm sure you're so happy for me. If you're new, because I know I was so thrilled for the people having a good time in AA when I got here. I was so overjoyed for them. And I would sit in my seat and I'd hear him talking about the new house and the family and the car, and I'd sit in my seat and I'd think to myself, you know, maybe you go home tonight, maybe the house will blow up. You know? Maybe your family will blow up. Maybe you'll blow up. Then we'll see how spiritual you are next week. If you're new here and you don't have alcoholism, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. We'd love to give it to you. When they told me when I was new that I was the most important person in the room, I misunderstood it. You see, at a heart transplant operation, the most important person in the room is laying on a table and his heart is being held in the hands of someone else. He's the most important person in the room. And if you're new here, I didn't get that that's what they meant when they were telling me that they were that I was the most important person in the room. If you're a drug addict, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're a dope fiend, which is somehow worse than any of us. I would like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous and suggest that you catch alcoholism. Catch it. Catch alcoholism. We don't have a book for dope fiend if you're a dope juggernaut, if you're the Bigfoot of dope addicts. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Catch alcoholism. We have a book written by alcoholics about alcoholism. And if you don't catch it, you die from it. And if you catch it, you get better. It's the weirdest disease I have ever, ever heard of. And I did not have it when I got here. I did not have alcoholism. Number one, I'm Jewish, and Jews don't drink. Because it might dull the pain. Right? you don't want that to happen. You don't want to squander any agony opportunity that presents itself. In addition to being Jewish, I could not have possibly been alcoholic. I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years. I was going to be dead, but I was going to understand it. I'm not putting therapy down. Therapy's great stuff. It says on page 133 of our book, if you need a doctor, go get one. My colossal blunder was that I was trying to treat my alcoholism with psychotherapy. Talk about showing up at a gunfight with a knife, man. I want to tell you. If alcoholism is a threefold illness, if it is a bizarre physical reaction that makes it impossible to stop drinking once I begin, and I keep taking a drink I know I shouldn't take because I've got some fascinating thinking. I have a new favorite reason for drinking. As I continue to work with new people in Alcoholics Anonymous, the reasons for drinking get better and better and better. I have a new winner. Just before I left town, I'm working with a guy. He lives with his wife. He is a male hustler. He's a male prostitute. And he has a gay lover. Why did he drink? He caught his wife cheating on him. It doesn't get much better than that, folks. Drop the bitch! What do you say? He asked me what I thought. Well, let's look it up in the book. Oh, my God. Oh. I went to the aquarium today. Between those jellyfish and Peg Morton's talk last night, I feel like I'm on an acid trip. Unbelievable. Jesus Christ. I've heard great talks. I'm really looking forward to hearing Greg tomorrow, and I've heard such great talks since I've been up here. It took me a long time to catch alcoholism and Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor is fond of saying that the infection takes place at the meetings, and it enters through the ear. The infection enters through the ear, an infection, then infects everybody around you, and it's a mess. But I caught alcoholism in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was brought up in the Bronx to a completely insane family. My witness protection program? Are you? My wife never believed me about my family until she met him. And my mom threw an engagement party for us, and my aunt came and wore her wig backwards, and it had a bun on it. It was not a mistake. It was a look she was going after. Nuttier than fruitcakes. Out of their minds. Certifiable, the lot of them. If you got something for free in my family, it meant it was stolen. And I had an uncle who was a welder, and he used to get free bales of steel wool. My aunt took a decorating course and made throw pillows and filled all of the throw pillows with the free steel wool. Now, after a while, that stuff works its way through on you. So when you were at their house, if you looked at the room, everyone was moving a little bit, you know? The whole room was just kind of undulating. It was like one big organism. It was like the jellyfish in the aquarium. The whole thing was moving and pulsing. And my family, if you're new here, all I have is good news. Because my family did not have one single solitary thing to do with making me an alcoholic. I said, not one thing to do with it. I'm not saying they weren't crazy. They were crazy. And I'm telling you, the cute stuff, there was chronic institutionalization, suicide attempts, crazy. I said they didn't have one thing to do with making me an alcoholic. See, if they had made me an alcoholic, if my family really had, I could go to psychotherapy, I could work out my family problems, and I could drink like a normal person. Stands to figure if they were the reason for my alcoholism. But if alcoholism is a threefold illness, if it's mental and physical and becomes spiritual, because you see, I have to start rearranging my life to accommodate the walk to the drink that I can't stop taking. And I eventually have to rearrange everything in my life to accommodate this walk that's going to happen. You see, I thought I was free. And if you're new and you're afraid of becoming an AA robot, let AA robot be a lofty goal. If you're scared of being brainwashed, maybe it could use a good scrubbing. And I had to eventually rearrange everything in my life. The longer I drank, the horrible cycle of spree and remorse, I had to rearrange what was acceptable to do as a father, a parent, as a husband, as a lover, as a son, as a cousin, as a brother. Everything had to be rearranged to accommodate this walk to the drink. Because I did anything alcoholism told me to do, I did it whenever it told me to do it for, and I did it for as exactly how long it told me to do it for. But I was a free man. And if you take a picture of your alcoholism, if you take the alcoholic test, and if you're new, we do have a test. It's called an inventory. It's a pass-pass situation. Do it and you pass. You'll actually be able to take a picture of your alcoholism. And when I took the picture of my alcoholism, I saw that early on people were doing things behind my back. And a little later on, they started talking behind my back. And in those last few horrible years, they started thinking behind my back. It's happened, obviously, to a few of you. It's a horrible, horrible thing. It's hard to catch them. But you can do it. You can catch them. I grew up in this insane family. My father thought he was a real loser, and I completely agreed with him. I thought he was a sap and a sucker. And he never made more than $10,000 a year, and my brother and I never missed a meal and never went to school with ripped clothing. And my last year out there, I made $80,000. My children went to school with ripped clothing all the time, and they missed meals all the time. How can such a thing happen? How can you put those two pictures down next to each other, and how can my dad come up a loser? Once a certain kind of thinking becomes established in you, anything is possible. If you're new here and you're not alcoholic, if you don't have alcoholism, and you've been getting drunk at exactly the wrong moment, if you build up a bright outlook for yourself and family and rip it down around your ears in a senseless series of sprees, if you fail to recall with sufficient force the memory of the pain and humiliation of a day, a week, a second ago, and repeat the same insane behavior over and over again, and you're not alcoholic, what is wrong with you? What is your problem? Consider the alternatives. You would do well to contract alcoholism. And I don't mean to offend anybody here. I'm going to talk about my other basic way of avoiding catching alcoholism for as long as I did. My first major way of avoiding alcoholism was by this psychotherapy that I started when I was 14 years old, because I really thought that this self-knowledge was going to help me avoid it. And the second way I did was by swapping addictions. And again, this is an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I've been asked to share my experience, strength, and hope, and how I'm living joyously with the 12 steps. And so I'm going to have to talk about drugs. And again, I don't mean, it says that the end of there is a solution. We don't mean for any of these self-revealing accounts to be to cause controversy or to be hurtful. But I it's impossible for me to tell my story without them. Because you see, I drank till I didn't want to be a drunk, and I smoked pot. And I'd like to welcome all the potheads here tonight. You remember WOW, right?
Wow. Wow.
And right after WOW usually came, what?
What?
Wow, what? Watching a pothead is like watching a dog try to run on a linoleum. You know? There's like a lot of activity, but no movement. They cannot get a claw in the rug. I triumphed over marijuana with pills. I was I was victorious over pills with cocaine. Cocaine's a fabulous drug. It's particularly good for sex if you enjoy sex from the Neolithic period. And I kicked that goddamn cocaine with heroin. Heroin's a very good, dark, complicated, artistic drug, and then you cross a line and become a vomiting pig. It's just a little hop, skip, and a jump. And I kicked that gall darn heroin and triumphed over it with alcohol. And then, and drank till I didn't want to be a drunk and didn't catch alcoholism. Didn't even begin to catch alcoholism till I was 33 years old. Till I was almost dead from it. Till my wife was almost dead from it. Till my kids were almost dead from it. I didn't even begin to catch it, you know. And my dad, I shot some heroin, and my dad had a massive stroke. I was in my early 20s, and I had to go to the hospital, and I couldn't show up for him or my mother or my brother. And I, there's a couple of times in a kid's life when he probably ought to be there for a dad, and this was it, and I couldn't answer the bell. The curtain was down. The sound of the heart machine couldn't even get through to me, and I felt like a pig, like an animal. And I knew exactly what the problem was. And I swore to God that I would never put a needle in my arm again. Because that's what had brought me to that place at that time. And I didn't. For 13 years, I didn't. I drank till I didn't want to be a drunk. I smoked pot till I didn't want to be a pothead. And I took pills till I didn't want to be like one of those people. And my father was lost to me. I couldn't go to hospitals. I couldn't look at pictures of him. I couldn't talk about him. I couldn't even hear the sound of a heart machine. And any time I'd think about him, this horrible, cold, black place would just come up, and I just, it's, you know, the memories where you just feel like you're being blindsided by a brick because there's no light there, and there's never going to be any light there. And shortly after my dad passed away, I met a beautiful, remarkable woman. She was exotic. She was from Detroit. And And to me, I've never been out of the Bronx. I'm telling you, Detroit was, I thought there was like palm trees in Detroit. I had never been out of the city, man. And this woman was just gorgeous and smart. And if you had written everything I did down in a book in 8 years of marriage and gave it to this woman and she read it and you said, would you live with this? She would have said, no, what reasonable human being would ever live with that? But you spread it out over 8 years. Throw in chronic success. Throw in the fact that when I started the walk to the drink, quite often I was telling the truth. Got a little murky over here. It was quite often an out-and-out lie by the time I got over here. But it was quite often the truth over here. And yeah, throw in a best-selling. By the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a book on the bestseller list. I had acted in a Broadway play. I had directed a television show. I had directed a movie. I had had my own theater in New York. I had done all of these things a time. I never got to do any of them more than once. Because when I'd leave, they'd move the business so I couldn't find it again, pretty much. Because they were thinking behind my back. What? Why? And Nancy became very sick from prolonged exposure to me. One day I came home. We had these 32-ounce iced tea tumblers, and I popped the cork on a bottle of wine. I emptied the entire bottle of wine into this tumbler. And I turn around, and I'm getting the pre-Al-Anon rat face. What? She said, what are you doing? And I said, I looked at her right in the eyes, and absolutely seriously, I said, I'm having a glass of wine. Can a man have a glass of wine in his own home? We became so sick together. At one point, a guy lent us his car, and we sold his car. I will never forget this guy's voice on the phone as long as I live.
You sold my car? I lent you my car. What do you mean you sold my car?
That's like house-sitting for someone, and they come back, and you're in escrow. Right? And we were sure we had done the right thing. It was the end of the month. We didn't have the rent. I looked at my wife with tears in my eyes, and I said, sweetheart, I am so sick of being irresponsible, of acting like a punk kid. I'm so sick. Let's not borrow money. Let's sell the car. And she looked at me with tears in her eyes and said, let's do. The alcoholic life becomes the only normal one. Nancy came home one day, and I had had an idea. I had an idea to cook something, but I died in the middle of the idea. There was an empty vial of pills laying by my body. I was had a pan of eggs on my chest, and the oven was on. And she tapped me with her foot and said, how are you? And I looked up, and I said, I'm really tired. So she called this doctor and told him what was going on, and the doctor said, why are you calling me? Why aren't you calling the paramedics? And she hung up the phone and then called another doctor for a second opinion. And the second doctor said, there's a blue Jew on the floor. Why don't you call the hospital? So, we had two children who became very sick from alcoholism. When Michael was born, and we were surrounded by friends and family, there were a ton of phone calls, lots of flowers at the hospital, and a ton of friends around, a lot of family. When Jesse was born 2 years and 9 months later, there was nobody at the hospital, no phone calls, no family, no friends, no flowers. We had repelled everybody around us. We had become completely isolated from the disease of alcoholism in 2 years and 9 months. And it's not because people didn't love us, they loved us. It hurt too much to be around us. And Jesse got sick, he had a heart deal, and had to go up into neonatal intensive care. And I was home with Micah. And this doctor calls me to the hospital and says, Mr. Redmond, your child and your wife really need you down here. I said, I understand that, but the fact is I can't find anybody to watch my two-year-old son. And this doctor, who I had never met before, said to me on the phone, I tell you what, I'll give you my address. Why don't you bring him over to my house and my husband will watch him? This is a doctor who I've never met before, and I said no. I said no because there was no way I could accept the help. I was too racked with guilt. I was too overwhelmed with self-loathing. Now I'm not doing my kid a favor. Now he's trapped in the house with this insane, sick man. I would have done better to take Micah to the hospital and leave him in the waiting room with a coloring book. At least he would have gotten away from me for a while. And this is the condition that my family came to Alcoholics Anonymous in. When my older son was 5 years old, he came to me and he said to me, "Daddy, is there anything such as God?" And I looked right into the eyes of my beautiful, perfect 5-year-old boy and I said, "No. No, son, there isn't." And I swear to you, I thought I was doing him a favor. I swear to you, I thought I was giving him the real deal, that I was saving him some time and some heartache. I wanted to help him not get played like a sap like the suckers out there. And what I did in essence was, I told him, I don't really think you can say a worse thing to a kid. I just don't. I can't imagine giving worse and less accurate information to a baby. Because it's mushy thinking. It's the mushiest, weakest thinking of all. But I told this baby that he was all alone in the universe. Now, we all know what happens when our head hits the pillow. And we know what happens to little kids when their head hits the pillow. You know what? They need all the help they can get. And I told him he was all alone. And on April 20th, 1985, I crossed a line I swore I would never cross again. I put a needle in my arm again because it was in front of me. I had no mental defense against it. I crossed a line I swore I would never cross. I called my therapist of record, and I told him what I had done, and he said to me, "There's absolutely nothing that can be done for you." I said, "What?" He was my first Jungian therapist. He said, "The only thing I can suggest to you is that you attend a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, or we have you institutionalized." Now, on most other days, I would have gladly chosen the institution. I would have been with my people, you know? Colorful, adventurous people, my people. Why I went to that AA meeting, I couldn't tell you. I'll tell you one thing. Once I was to read our book and find out that Carl Jung played no small role in the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous, once I was to find out that Carl Jung told the man who 12-stepped the man who 12-stepped Bill Wilson exactly the same thing that that man said to me that morning. He said, "There's absolutely nothing that can be done for you." And my God, which was psychotherapy, forsook me completely. Now, why I went to the AA meeting, I don't know. But if you're anything like me, and you're new, and you're sitting in this room tonight, you are saying to yourself, "Alcoholics Anonymous, how lame is this? Oh, no. Oh, no. This is beyond lame. This is lamer than church, lamer than synagogue. This is some plateau of lameness I never even imagined was available to me. Alcoholics Anonymous, oh, no. No. Welcome. Okay. You're the most important person in the room. And they get right up in your face and talk that unsolicited AA crap to you, man. Right up in your face. They get right. It's usually a guy with one tooth with a cavity in it, right? Wearing a belt buckle large enough to serve a whole fish on. You know the guy, right? You know the guy. "Do I want what you've got? No. No. But thanks for spitting on me. I really appreciate it." I looked around the room, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. Everything was a miracle. Miracle, miracle, miracle. The furniture's a miracle, the coffee's a miracle. Miracle, miracle, miracle. Oh. I hated everything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I do not know why I stayed. I would not have known a step if it bit me on the face. The only thing that I can come up with is that I was out of plans. And if you are new here, I pray for you that you are out of plans. If you are new and you have a plan, it's probably a beaut. Don't use your plan.
Grab one of us after the meeting. Tell us the plan. We want to know the plan.
I have a favorite newcomer plan, and it's the most popular newcomer plan over the last couple of years. I've just heard it more than any one. It's the one more dope deal to set myself up financially for sobriety plan. What? Yeah. It's going to wind up on the soft literature rack eventually, I think. I don't know why I stayed here, but I did. And I stuck around for 6 months, and I saw the AA drill. I saw it 100 times. I saw it hundreds of times in just 6 months. People came in, did the work, changed. People didn't do the work, didn't change. Got sick, got sicker, got to the podium, shared their gift with us. And then shared themselves right out of the room. Right out of the room. And I saw it hundreds and hundreds of times in just 6 months. You know? And I was 6 months sober. I was enjoying the gift of step none. You know the gift of step none? Nothing! And what had happened was my wife reached out to the Al-Anon family groups. One of the most hurtful and confusing things to me when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous was I heard people telling jokes about Al-Anon from podiums of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And my wife had reached out to the Al-Anon family groups, and I was so relieved and so proud of her. And until I understood, until I stuck around long enough to find out that the people who were doing that from the podium were ignorant of Al-Anon and just being hurtful, although I judge no man, and until I was to find out that they had no functioning knowledge of the work that's done in the Al-Anon family groups, I was very confused and upset by it. And because I'd be sitting there going, hold it, isn't like this a good thing? Isn't this, shouldn't we be as proud as we're trying to be of ourselves here? What's this? You know? So I'm just saying, you know, if you're doing that kind of thing from the podium, you're casting your vote that it's okay to do. I used to have all the votes. I'm down to one now. And my vote is that it's not okay. My vote is that it's not okay because there might be a newcomer. Yeah. There might be a newcomer who's lucky enough to be involved with somebody who's going after their own miracle and finding their own God. You know, it's a beautiful thing. If you read the original transcript of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous before it was sent out for everybody's notes, the difference in the way the 12th step was worded is in that original manuscript that originally read, carried this message to others, especially alcoholics. And the only difference, there's only one word difference in the Al-Anon 12 steps, and it says carried this message to others. So I'm glad that when they split it, we wound up with two programs. One of them carrying to others, one of them carrying to just alcoholics. And what was happening in my house at that time is my wife had reached out and was getting her own miracle. And my sons were less frightened. Micah, when I got here, was making involuntary clicking noises with his throat that he couldn't stop making. He was grinding his teeth. He was cut off from the society of other children. He tested in excess of 168 IQ, and he could barely read or write because he was crippled up with fear all the time. Here comes Dad, the psychological theme park. What ride will we be taking today? And if you're my kid, thank you, Diane, and you're in between me and the drink, I got to either walk through you or walk around you, but I'm always going to get to the drink. You either have to vanish or you have to turn to paper mache. You either have to disappear or you have to become something less than human because that's the way I'm going to treat you. How much vanishing can a baby bear before they believe what they're being taught, which is that they don't exist? And that's the invisible state that my kids came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in. So I was 6 months sober, and I knew I was going to drink. I had seen ample proof of it hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times. But the program had reared its head in my family just enough so that I asked the guy to sponsor me. And I did something I rarely did in my life. I went to a good guy for something he had. That was contrary action for me. I usually went to bad people for stuff they didn't have. I usually went to drowning people and asked for swimming lessons. And when all they could say was glub, 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 I'd get pissed off. But I went to a good guy for stuff he had. And he made sure I did some reading in the Big Book. and invited me over to his apartment, and he read chapter 5 to me. And on the way through, he took me through the first two steps. We reached step 3, and we made a decision together and got on our knees and prayed. And he finished reading chapter 5 to me and went back and gave me instructions on how to do an inventory from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I know some people say, and I know it's true for them, that they mostly resented themselves. I know it's true for them, and I know it's absolutely not true for me. I hated myself, but nothing compared to how much I hated you. I hated you so much more than I hated me, it's difficult to explain it. I am not a suicide person. I'm a homicide person. Right? And I vastly prefer your death to mine. I always have. And I'm not knocking the suicide people. Right? This is not a put down. It's just kind of the flip side of the same coin. But you go before me every time. I always saw his headlines that Scott Redmond kills wife, kills kids, and refuses to commit suicide. That was always my thing. So I had a lot of work to do. I took 3 months. I did my inventory. I went back to my sponsor at 9 months of sobriety, and I read it to him. I did step 6 and 7 for the first time, and then it came time to write my 8-step list. Oh, man. The best reading of the 8-step I ever heard in my life, and I try to share it every time I talk, was done by a guy named Nino. I've never seen Nino again since the night I heard him read chapter 5, and I had never met him before. He had never read chapter 5 before. It was at my old home group, this men's group. He was there with a hospital group. He had a hospital plastic on. He had a heavy New York accent. And I've never seen him again. He was reading chapter 5 for the first time. He got up to step 8, and he read. Made a list of all those we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Jesus Christ! And he looked out into the room as if to say, have you seen it? Do you know what's in here, man? It was so pure. It was so beautiful. It's all I saw when I saw the steps. No, not those people, not that money, man. I would not have taken that much money if I knew how to pay it back. Right? Right? No way. No way would I have taken that much. Not the car. So if you're new here, don't worry. It's 8 steps from where you are anyway. So don't worry. And it's not 8 that's really annoying. It's 9. 9's really... So I did my 8-step list. I didn't want to put my dad down there. He was dead. And my sponsor asked if I owed him amends. I said, yeah, but what am I going to do? And he said, I don't know. I don't know, but if you need to make an amends to him, you put him down the list. But I said, what am I going to do? And he said, I don't know. Why don't you do your job in Alcoholics Anonymous and see what happens? I had to put my wife and my kids down there. Now, this is just for me. For me, and I know people put themselves on their 8-step list. I know some people put themselves on the top of their 8-step list. And I know they do it because they should. I know that I needed to not be on my 8-step list. I needed to not be anywhere near it. I had been making amends to myself at your expense, hopefully, my whole life. And I am not knocking people who do that. Men I sponsor do that. But I've been asked to share what my experience with the steps have been. And I needed to not be on that list. My wife needed to be on it. Let's see, what'll I do? I'll sit down and I'll say, Nan, I'm sorry about this 8-year trip to Hades. Okay? I don't think so. Or I'll sit down with my kids and I'll say, gee, boys, sorry you've had no life. I had to start doing my job in Alcoholics Anonymous. And something that I heard Dick M. say a long time ago, what I've never forgotten. I knew my sponsor was a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous, not because he told me he was, because he showed me he was. And I started watching him really closely, and I started doing the stuff that these guys were doing. You guys told me I wasn't bad getting good. I was sick getting well. I believe that. But I also, you see, I might not have been a bad guy, but I did a real good imitation of a bad guy. And because I did bad stuff all the time. And it's an amazing thing. I started acting like a good guy, and I started feeling like a good guy. So I get it, but I had to really start doing that stuff, you know. And I started doing my job in AA. I was a writer when I got sober. I had this writing job. I wasn't one of God's kids yet. I was still a writer. And I had this job ghostwriting for 20th Century Fox, and I turned about a year sober, and I was up to direct the situation comedy, and I didn't get the job, and I almost drank. And I went to my sponsor, and I told him what had happened. I was humiliated, and he said, "Oh, I guess you still have the show business God." I said, "What?" He said, "Well, you had the show business God. He failed you utterly, and so you had to drink." He said, "Why don't you sit and write a 10-step, because you're resentful at this company for not giving you the work." I was resentful at myself for almost drinking because I was humiliated. And I did the inventory. I read it to him. And I got on my knees and I did steps 6 and 7. Humbly ask him to remove these shortcomings. Humbly isn't, "Take him if you can, big guy." Humbly isn't, "Take him, you rotten son of a bitch." Humbly is, "Can you please, please do this for me? I've had it. I'm done. Can you do this to me? I'll draw close to you. Will you reveal yourself to me and tell me what I can do for you? Will you please do my work? I'll do your work, and I'll start this relationship." You know? And I got on my knees, and I asked for relief, and I said, "Father, please, you can have show business too. Take show business too. I want a God big enough so that show business and all this..." Because I heard, when I came in here, I heard about God getting people into relationships, getting people out of relationships. I heard God getting people parking spaces. Not the parking God. Not the parking God. What if you don't get a space? What happens? If you got a parking God, that's fine. I couldn't have a parking God. That could bracket all this other stuff. And I said, "You take show business. I'll do anything for a living. Just keep me sober." And within 3 months, I was working as a cook on a catering truck. And I looked up to God and I said, "I didn't mean this. I didn't mean this. We've had a grotesque misunderstanding. I did not mean this." Now in L.A., when they shoot a movie or make a TV show, they have a caterer that follows the company around and feeds them. It's a great job. You make a lot of dough. But I'm Scott Redman. So I'm catering this movie, and the executive producer and star of the movie is a guy who I've worked with in the business. And he sticks his head on the truck that morning, and he says, "Can I have a burrito?" "Scott?" And I turn around, I said, "What's happening, man?" He said, "Well, is this your truck?" I said, "No, but it's my spatula." After work, I called my sponsor and I said, "Oh, we're getting the gift of sobriety now, pal." "Oh, it's a miracle. Miracle." He said, "Sounds like you've got a resentment." Must have gone to a retreat to learn that, right? And I sat down and I wrote, "I'm resentful at Scott for working on a kitchen truck. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. A 5-bagger for sure." Now, resentment's no big deal. It's just the source of all spiritual illness, the great destroyer of all alcoholics. It'll cut you off from the sunlight of the spirit, drag your ass out, and kill you dead. But don't be alarmed. No biggie. I'm going to die. I'm going to die. What am I going to ask God to remove? The burrito? The truck? The guy? What am I asking God to take away? I'm going to die. God's got a magic wand. Blue skies. He comes down and touches me on the head. What is it in me? If it disappeared like this, would I be able to live another day? What is the poison in me? It ain't the burrito. It ain't the truck. And it ain't the guy. I have false pride. I'm impatient. Things aren't moving along. I'm ungrateful. I'm making dough. Guys get sober, they don't even get to work. I'm ashamed. I'm playing God. Things aren't going according to the Scott Redman program, a fabulous program. I'm a people pleaser.
This is the list I had to sit down and read to my sponsor and then get on my knees and say, can you help me out here? Can you help me show up tomorrow and try to give them a dime for their nickel? Can you help me show up there and keep bringing a little dough into this house so that the boys aren't scared all the time? Can you, and what started happening? You see, up to that point, my head, when it hit the pillow, if you're new here and when your head hits the pillow, it becomes a rotisserie. What started to happen was I started falling asleep. I mean, I started going to sleep, man. And 18 years of psychotherapy didn't even take the edge off the sound. You know? And I started showing up, and I started being able to be helpful to some people who came into AA and thought they had fallen from a height. They didn't understand that if you can become one of God's kids, there's no place to fall. It's the top rank here. You don't get higher than God's kid. And if you attain that degree, you don't get to fall anywhere. And a friend of mine, it's a truth. And I got to do this for a while, and I would have chosen, if God had asked me how I would like to be helpful, I probably wouldn't have chosen this particular way, but I wound up serving people, actors I had directed in television shows, and I wound up serving people who had been my assistant directors and stage managers and stuff like that, and man, I got to show up and carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and start feeling like a grown man for the first time in my life, because my whole life I stood next to men 10 years younger than me and said, I wonder what it's like to be grown up, and that's a crappy way to live. If you're a man or a woman and you don't feel grown up and you've been looking at other people and saying that, I'm just telling you, this is what you people have done for me. I came in here and I felt like a busted up, ugly, broken down little boy. And today I feel like a handsome, grown-up man for the first time in my life because of what's happened to me at Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? And I had been doing this about 3 or 4 years, and I really was doing great. And I did on this one show, and I got a call from this company in New York called Ketchum Public Relations, a big public relations company. And because of the book I had written, they made an overture to me to do this big comedy writing job for them. And I did a videotape for them about it, and I did all this stuff, and I started getting the brain fever back. I thought this would be good for me, this job would be good for me, and maybe help some of the men I sponsor. And I crashed and burned before I even heard about the job. I went nuts, my brain exploded, I became an outtake from Scanners, I went mad. I did the inventory, read it to my sponsor, prayed about it, and released it. I'm done. A couple of weeks go by, I get a call from Ketchum. I didn't get the job. I'm fine. Hang up the phone. Phone rings. It's my catering company. Can I go and cater some commercials up in Lake Arrowhead? Yeah. I get up the truck. I get up to Arrowhead, and I grab the call sheet. Who are the commercials for? Ketchum Public Relations. I'm feeding them now. Now I'm feeding them. I look down at the foot of the truck, and there's a guy with a videotape camera. He's taping me. I said, what are you taping? He said, oh, we're taping the making of the commercial. They're taping my humiliation. They go back to New York, show the guy the tape, and the guy goes, is that Scott Redmond with the meatloaf there? That, oh, my God. After work, I go back, I call my sponsor, and I said, oh, we're really getting the gift now. Oh, and the miracle is a little bigger. And he said to me, I guess God had enough writers and he needed a few cooks today. Then he said, you know, you told God you wanted to work for Ketchum and you forgot to tell him what you wanted to do. What started happening with my children was a pretty remarkable thing. My son Micah, who I told you about, who was so terrified that he became such a wreck physically and emotionally. I was about a year sober when I started sponsoring men. I'm very fortunate that I was able to work with men that young in sobriety. And one of the first guys I sponsored, his name was Roland. And Roland used to call me every night, and he would leave a message on my machine every night, whether or not I was there. And the message would say, "Scott, it's Roly. I love you. I'm sober. Good night." And years later, my son Micah told me that he couldn't fall asleep until he heard Roland's voice on the tape. And once he heard Roland's voice on the tape, he knew nothing had changed and he could go to sleep. Because that was the demonstration of the power of God in Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't, "I'm sorry, son. I'm sorry" were the two most useless words in my vocabulary. What was the demonstration was you guys showing up, calling every day, marching in and out of my house, and getting up in my face and talking that unsolicited long AA crap to me. And I didn't even know about this until years later. Years later, Micah told me about this. And, of course, he told us at a time when Roland was positive he had not helped anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. He told us at a time when Roland needed to know this to stay sober one day at a time. And my poor, beautiful, perfect boy, you see, he didn't have to learn how to believe in God. He had God brought to him. This is the kid who I told there was no God. He had God delivered special delivery to his house every day. You know, the guys in AA found out my younger son wanted to learn how to play drums, and a drum set appeared at my house. One guy brought over a snare drum, one guy brought over a cymbal. He had his sobriety drum set. You know, this is the kind of group that I hang around with in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? And I got up to a podium and said about how proud I was that I took some of my beer money and bought my kid a drum pad and a pair of sticks because he told me he wanted to play drums. And what an incredible thing that is that I could do that. And the guys in the group said, "Yeah, and this." They're throwing car keys at the kid, you know. In that realm, to show them what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for us, you know. I had to start doing a lot of lame crap. I had to start showing up at Little League games, you know. If you're new here, this is, you know, my sponsor said, do your job in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to start coaching flag football. You know, the first Little League game I go to, my wife comes to the game. She looks over at the first base stands and falls down laughing because there's the people in the first base stands, and there's me alone in the sun, pissed off, right? I'm here. I'm doing my job. I'm here. I'm going up and down two hat sizes, right? I'm here. The kids were thrilled to see me, you know? Mr. Redman's going to blow up. I'm telling you, man. It took me a couple of years for the voices to diminish in volume and number to go and just be with the people in the first base stands. A couple of months ago, my son had this concert at school, and I sat down in this auditorium at school, and I almost started to cry because I was just in the auditorium with the people. And Jesse took a bongo solo. He's a percussionist. And he got up and he looked over the first couple of rows of musicians, and he hit me with just a little stuff. He caught his old man, and he just hit me with that much stuff. When I was a couple of years sober, I was at my sobriety station in the first base stands, you know, and my son got one of the greatest compliments a kid can get. He was intentionally walked, you know. Doesn't get a lot better than that, folks. You know? And he didn't want to be a dork and jump up and down and scream and yell. He just put his bat down, and he trotted up the first baseline, and on the way up, he turned to me because I'm at my sobriety station, and he just shot me that much stuff. That much stuff. Not too much. It's the old man. You don't want to be lame. Just a little bit, right? Just that much stuff. And I could have missed the whole thing. And I'm not telling you Jesse got intentionally walked because I'm sober. I'm telling you I was at my sobriety station because I'm sober. And my beautiful Micah, my big son, my big, beautiful son, he's a communist. I've asked him to call the main office. Things don't seem to be working out too well, but my in-laws live in Orange County, and I love to watch him talk to them. Kind of interesting. And I was a couple of years sober, and Michael, who was so crushed up and scared, who I told you about, I was making the boys lunch, and I said, "What do you want on your hot dog?" And Michael said, "I want mustard, onions, and lettuce." I said, "Lettuce?" He said, "Oh, okay, I don't want lettuce." And he walked away, and he came back about 45 minutes later and looked at me directly in the eye, and I'm not altering one syllable. He said, "I will never again allow your opinion of what I want affect what I ask for." So I asked him to sponsor me.
What's that? What is that? A couple of months ago, the kids were fighting. Jesse had a broken wrist. It's in a growth plane. If you know anything about kids, that's a dangerous thing. The brake can't get disturbed. And Micah was rough with him, and I got right up in his face, and I drew the limb, and I chewed him out. And he walked away from me, and he slammed his door. Now I got the dad tick, you know, he slammed the door. So I go to the door, and I open the door, and before I can go, he looks at me, and he says, "Hold it. I didn't tell you you were wrong in there. You were right. But a big guy just got up and screamed right in my face. Don't tell me I can't be mad." What's that? What is that? That's Alcoholics Anonymous. That's not retaliation. That's not repression. That's telling you how I feel without telling you what to do. That's what you've taught me how to do. That's a hell of a way to live. A hell of a way to live. I'd love to take no crap and give none. That's the way I'd like to live. That's the way my heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous live. Nancy and I had to stop working on our marriage. My idea of working on a relationship is to talk to you until you change your mind. My idea of working on a relationship is to talk to you until your eyes roll back in your head and you keel over, and on the way down you go, "Oh, okay." And Peg was talking about it last night. It's something that Nancy's sponsor taught her and that we've been able to show other people. And it's how to start taking the traditions and applying them to the group at home. And man, the gifts we have received from this have been absolutely extraordinary. And for me, the font of it is the sexual inventory in our book. And once I was to take a look at it, we were asked to write about 7 different points in that inventory on page 69. If you're new here, I'm sure you're so thrilled that you get to do a sexual inventory. I'm sure you're just going to dash home and start it. It asked us to write about 7 different points. Where have I been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Where have I unjustifiably aroused jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness? And here's the hook. What should I have done instead? Not what could I have done. What could I have done? What I did. What should I have done? It says, in this way I try to shape a sound ideal for my future life. I ask God to help me, help mold me, help me walk toward it. I actually get to write about the guy I've always wanted to be and never acted like, and then I get to take some steps to have God walk me toward it. This is astounding. And I'm telling you, they call it moral psychology because just psychology never did this for me because I couldn't act morally. You know? And when I started taking a look at my marriage, and why I felt like a little kid, and applying this inventory to it, extraordinary stuff started happening. Where have I been selfish? I want what I want when I want it. Where have I been dishonest? Man, when I started taking a real look at this, for instance, you might think a man should live in a clean house, right? That's something a grown-up would do. Live in a clean house, be proud of where he lives, make a bed, that kind of stuff. So you think that I'm like cleaning my house because a man should live in a clean house. But no. Somewhere in the back of my head, I think that a certain amount of housework should equal a certain amount of sex. Right? That there should be like conversion tables on the back of cleaning products. Right? Of housework to sex. So I'm not cleaning the house to live in a clean house. I'm cleaning the house and going, "I'm finished, honey." When I started cleaning the house to live in a clean house, I started feeling like a grown man. I started feeling like a grown man for the first time in my life. Plus, I don't know how to clean the house, and I don't want to. So I say, "Father, I'm doing this for you. Father, I'm vacuuming for you. Father, I'm doing the dishes for you. Father, I'm doing this for you because I don't know how to do it, and I don't want to do it." I went on a 12-step call with my sponsor early on. We went to this guy's house, me and about 5 other guys, and I went to use this guy's bathroom. And underneath his toilet paper dispenser, there were about 6 or 7 empty cardboard tubes from the toilet paper. This guy had changed the toilet paper rolls 6 or 7 times and couldn't throw out the tubes. And that's alcoholism. That, for me, now some of you might see that and it might mean nothing to you. My heart froze because I know what has to happen to a man to get into that place. That, to me, was a bigger sign of alcoholism than if there had been 50 million bottles all around the house. You know? And I don't live that way anymore.
So Nancy and I started practicing these principles in our marriage, and I continue to do my job in Alcoholics Anonymous. Early on in my sobriety, I was online to get lunch and buy lunch, and there was this guy in front of me, and he was buying a can of Colt 45 malt liquor with, like, you know, a loose change and lint and, you know, a half-eaten milk dud, you know. You know the guy. He had been there for like a week, you know. And he turned around, and instead of saying in my best New York, what are you looking at? I said, how you doing? And he said, you don't know how I'm doing. Nobody knows how I'm doing except for the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. So we went outside and we swapped numbers, and I went on my first real 12-step call that night. And I got a guy with more time than me, and we were told to take this guy to County General Hospital, a fabulous palatial institution, and dump him off at the door. Don't go in with him. Don't show them that he's got any resources. Just leave him at the door and book. I don't know why, but we went in with him. We went through the entire process all the way up to the alcoholic ward with the guy. And about halfway through, he turns to us and he says, I feel like I'm dying. And the guy I'm with time, says to him, that's because you are. And I got the guy with time. I pulled him over and I said, how could you say such a cold, insensitive thing to this guy, right? I'm scared he's not going to like us, right? But how could you say? Now, the guy is in a county facility. He's been told to lie that he's got blood in his urine to break his way into an alcoholic ward. What is the guy supposed to say? You're just having a bad day. You're just having a bad day. No, this isn't a bad day. This is what dying feels like. I'll let you know when you're having a bad day. This isn't it. And yet, if you stick around Alcoholics Anonymous for any appreciable amount of time, you will see men and women walk into this program with bottoms that will make your hair stand on end. You will look at that man or woman and you will say to yourself, no way they're ever drinking again. No way. Can't happen. Not after what they've been through this time. And after a period of time, if they do not treat their alcoholism with the program of action outlined in our book, it won't be their bottom anymore. It'll be a period of time where they were having a lot of bad days, where people were thinking behind their back, and they will get on with the business of dying, and it is bone-chilling, and I hope it never stops chilling my bones. Sometime after this, a guy who I sponsor ripped off some people in the program. He stole some money, he did a car, he did an apartment, and he was making me look pretty bad. And I wanted to explain a few things to him, and my sponsor said, nah, I don't think so. Why don't you sit down and write a 10-step? Because it says in our book, when someone offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man, God save me from being angry, thy will be done, not mine. It doesn't say it to them, and it doesn't say it to yourself loud enough so that they can hear you. It just says, say it to yourself. Now, I know some people pray for people they have resentments for. I don't. It doesn't work for me, and I know it works for them, and I'm not putting it down. But I got a problem. I start the prayer, and I say, Father, help this man. Kill him. Kill him. He needs killing. Kill the rotten son of a bitch. It'll be good for him, and it'll be good for us. So I had to stop doing that. So I pray for myself. I say, God save me from being angry. That will be done with mine. And I sit down and I write, I'm resentful at blank for ripping people off in AA and making me look bad. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. Little knock in the crotch there, a little ego blow. What are the defects that if God would remove, the resentment would be gone? Well, the guy's sick. If I can't appreciate that somebody's sick, I can't show intolerance, pity, or patience. So one of my defects obviously has to be that I'm unwilling to accept the fact that another one of God's kids could be spiritually sick like who? Like me. Right? I'm a people pleaser. I care more about how I'm being seen in the program than what this guy's going through. I'm self-centered. You know, selfish, self-centered, and self-seeking are the same but kind of different, you know? Selfish is wanting it all for me. Self-centered is kind of thinking it's all about me, and self-seeking is trying to figure out what's in it for me. And when I talk to God, I like to try to be as specific as I can, because otherwise, when I take the third step, I say, Father, I'm yours. And he says, well, yeah, I knew that. I'm God. But thanks. Thank you for the gesture. I really appreciate that. So when I can get specific and I can say, Father, can you take this people-pleasing, this self-centeredness, this unwilling to accept spiritual sickness, this impatience with his, you know, recovery, this spiritual pride, that's a new one, didn't get that till I came into AA and became a spiritual Goliath, right? How dare this man comport himself thusly after coming into someone of my spiritual caliber? It's hard to believe. And I went to God and I prayed about it. And sometime after this gentleman found out that he had a fatal illness. And he called a city agency and they said, look, all we can do is take you down to County General and dump you off at the door. And I knew that that wasn't true because I had done my job in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he couldn't call anybody else because they had either told him what they thought of him or he had just burnt them out. And I had kept my mouth shut only because of the direction of a loving sponsor and because I had done my job in Alcoholics Anonymous and I got to be there for this guy during his death. And my father came back into my life. And it didn't happen like a flash, but I got to be there for a guy when I couldn't be there for Dad. And all of a sudden, I felt that black place was going, man. I was able to tell his grandsons about him. I was able to talk about him. I was able to hear the sound of a heart machine without it feeling that it was a personal indictment of me. You guys gave me my dad back. I have a great relationship with him today. And I have the gift of a sober, loving son, and I give it to a lot of other people. Who am I to say to God, thank you for the gift of a sober, loving son, but if I don't get it to give it to Davy Redmond, I'll give it to no one. I don't get to do that. And subsequently, and Peg and I were talking about this briefly earlier, one of the men who I sponsor died about 4 weeks ago. And I held him while he died. And we took the first three steps together. We took the seventh step together. And I looked at my sweet Jimmy. I looked him in the eyes and I said, do you know that you've done good work here? And he said, yes, I do. And then he turned to a guy by the side of the bed and he said, I'm okay. I'm sober. And then he went to God. What's that? How does that happen? How does that happen to a self-centered column of human sewage? How do you do that? How do you be that kind of example? He changed the life of everybody in that room. Permanently. For good. Drunk or sober, he changed them. This guy touched a lot of people. And I got to be there because you put me back on the road. God doesn't drive parked cars. And you gave me the tools to pull it back on the road, you know. If you're new here and you're wondering when you're going to get in touch with your feelings, stay sober. They'll get in touch with you. If you're wondering when you'll find a God, work the steps, go to meetings, you'll be contacted. If you're new here, I want to tell you that I think you're in a very dangerous situation. Sometimes a newcomer will say to me, geez, drinking is the furthest thing from my mind. To which I usually reply, no, your mind is the furthest thing from your mind. And this isn't a criticism, and I'm not putting you down, but let me tell you why I'm so incredibly unimpressed by the proximity of drink to your mind. As far as I understand it, virtually the entire big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is engineered to try to drive home one point. That when drinking is the furthest thing from your mind, you put whiskey in your milk. That when drinking is the furthest thing from your mind, you cross the threshold of the hotel and you think, geez, a couple of cocktails would be fabulous with dinner. It doesn't say, you'll see it, it'll be a little drink. On the distance, you'll talk about it a little bit. Next day, you'll think about it a little more. It'll be a little bigger. Next day, a little more. It says, boom, you're drunk. Boom, you're drunk. Boom, your life keeps running out between your fingers like a handful of water over and over and over again. You don't have the thing that is necessary for sobriety. We know it. Unless you've had a big flash. I mean, a sober flash. A big flash. You know, you can't get sober without a spiritual experience. We know you haven't had one yet. Don't drink until you have one. That's this horrible gray period, this horrible netherworld. And I want to tell you, I think you're in a very, very dangerous situation. And I want to suggest that you act like somebody who is in a dangerous situation. You know, if you're going to parties where people are getting loaded, you know, when Jonah got out of the belly of the whale, he didn't go back in to get his hat. If you're comfortable around drugs, I'm so proud of you. By the way, it's illegal. Tell the police how comfortable you are. some time ago, I was on the phone with a guy. Thank you. And my wife was walking through the room. I was on the phone with a new guy. And all Nancy heard me say was, okay, let's say the aliens are coming. So Nancy stopped. She ain't missing a second of this. I said, that's an outside interest. I'm not telling you the aliens aren't coming. I got one question for you. Why are they coming for you? You have no life. You're 11 seconds sober. Why have they traversed the universe for your sorry ass? Plus, he's sleeping with the Bible on his chest to ward them off. They're going to traverse a galaxy, walk in and go, oh no, the Bible, let's go back to Xenon. I was telling this story at a meeting once, and the guy who had done it with was in the crowd, and I looked at him, and he went like this, ah, oh, man. And I saw him remember that it was him. It was... I met this guy in a meeting. I went home. He was 14 days sober. He called me up and he talked to me for an hour. I said, four times, so he knew I wasn't dead. And he told me that he had been stalking several women. He had a restraining order taken out against him, but he's 2 weeks sober now. Everything's different. And then at the end of the hour, he said, I feel so all alone. I said, well, I hardly even know yet. And I just listened to you for an hour without interrupting you. What do you mean you feel all alone? And he said, I mean, I don't have a woman. And I said to him, just exactly what would you be bringing to a relationship right now besides stalking skills? What are you bringing to the party, pal? People 2 weeks into remission from leukemia are not having dating problems. Alcoholics are. If you're bored, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to tell you my favorite story about being bored before I sit down tonight. And if you're new here, I want to thank you for sitting through my entire talk, unless, you know, you're in a coma now. You're my hero if you're here and your brain still feels like a crock pot, man. But if you're bored, I just want to tell you my favorite story about being bored in AA. It happened to this friend of mine named Jeff D. in my old home group. And he was new and he was shifting around in his seat. He was a couple of days sober at this meeting and his sponsor said to him, what's the matter? And Jeff said, I'm bored. And the sponsor said, well, you know why you're bored? Jeff said, no. And the sponsor said, you're bored because you're boring. That's why you're bored. And Jeff went, wow. Wow. It was like an acid moment for him. Wow. He thought, what a cool thing to say to a newcomer, you know? He could hardly wait till a newcomer told him that they were bored. 13 years later, he is 13 years sober. No newcomer has ever told him that they're bored. He's at a meeting with a young lady who is new. She's shifting around in her seat. And he says, what's the matter? She says, I'm bored. He says, well, you know why you're bored? She said, yeah, because I'm with you. If you're new here, don't drink. It'll screw up your sobriety. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome home.